beginning of September 2009, I interviewed Scott Reeves, who is a sociologist and health services researcher in Toronto. Thank you, Scott, for meeting with me this afternoon.
Pleasure.
All right, so maybe if we could just start off with you introducing yourself and telling us a little bit about your role as a sociologist and health services researcher here at St. Michael's Hospital.
Okay, as you know, my name's Scott Reeves. I'm a scientist here at the Lee Cushing Knowledge Institute. I'm also an associate professor at the University of Toronto. I am also a director of research at the Centre for Faculty Development and a scientist at the Wilson Centre for Research and Education at Toronto. So basically I have a number of sort of different roles, but my all my kind of jobs coalesce around looking at interprofessional education and interprofessional practice. And when we're talking about interprofessional education, interprofessional practice, we're looking at how different health and social care professions like medicine, like nursing, like social work, when they come together to sort of learn together to actually therefore work better in practice together, because healthcare demands people to work and collaborate in an effective manner, and often professionals who come through don't necessarily have the skills or expertise to collaborate on an interprofessional basis. So we try to develop approaches to improve the way that they can actually work together.
It's very fascinating. Maybe if you could talk a little bit more about sort of your research methodologies and the approaches that you use.
Sure. I primarily am a qualitative researcher, and I've been working and doing qualitative research for about 15 years now. And qualitative research is an approach which allows you to look at issues in depth. So often I use observations, so I'll go and watch teams in action, for instance, or go and watch learning in action. And also it relies on sort of in-depth interviewing as well. So I'll often sort of be engaged in interviewing people to understand the way that they see the world, the way that they understand the things that they do as well. So primarily looking at qualitative research. And there's a branch of qualitative research called ethnography, which is which I'm very interested in doing and undertaking. And that's a sort of type of qualitative research which is essentially around hanging out and trying to get an in-depth insight into sort of local cultures, how, for instance, a team culture would operate. So that's the sort of qualitative side. I've done a lot of work on systematic reviews, and that's the type of research which goes out there, searches for all the evidence for particular approaches, and then collates them and synthesizes them mainly for policymakers, for practitioners to be able to use to inform them what we know about interprofessional education, for instance. And finally, I do a thing called mixed methods evaluation. So I'm often commissioned to do evaluation work on programs, and I will employ sort of the qualitative methods that I've spoken about, and also quantitative methods. And this is often surveys with people. So we'll do surveys on teamwork or surveys on how people thought their interprofessional experiences were.
That's really great. You spoke a little bit about the ethnography. So maybe if you could tell us a little bit more about ethnographic research methodologies and sort of how ethnographic research helps people better understand a population of people and how it can challenge the assumptions that society has about people.
Right. Well, as I said, ethnographic work is about trying to understand local cultures. And often an ethnographer will go to a community and we'll hang out, as I mentioned. And it's about sort of just trying to get an insider's perspective on what's happening in that local community. And often it's around the ethnographer sort of talking with people, you know, watching what they do, you know, hanging out with them, just to get that insider sort of perspective. So in many ways it can be useful to particularly in relation to sort of homelessness. You know, an ethnographic approach would be very useful because the researcher would go out and seek out those people, would, you know, talk with them, would get a sense of what it is in terms of the way that they live their lives. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's a far more useful approach than trying to do a survey of you know, homeless people. So what you get is a sort of in-depth view. You don't really get ethnography is not around giving you a sort of broad understanding. It's about giving you an in-depth understanding, which may then you can use it for sort of doing other types of research. Mm-hmm. So it essentially allows you to, as I said, develop those rich insights. As about in terms of challenging assumptions, I mean, there's a type of ethnography which is sort of critical ethnography, and that goes in, and the whole idea of that is about challenging on sort of normative assumptions of the world. So you can certainly take an ethnographic approach and marry it to a critical approach. So, and a critical approach is a more sort of philosophical sort of grounding. So people like Marx, like Foucault, have a sort of, are your sort of critical theorists. And you can adopt that sort of way of thinking to shape the way you collect the data, the way you think about the data that you're gathering through your ethnographic methods. So that, therefore, that would challenge people's assumptions.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So it must be quite a lengthy process, ethnographic research.
It certainly is, because the idea is to get that idea about how people are working, how they're interacting, how they see the world. So it's not something you can do in an afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
You have to go in there. Often there's a period where you're building up trust with people, and then then your field work can extend over weeks, over months, and in some cases over years.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lengthy process, but it gives you a richness which you don't get from any other type of research.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And Scott, I know that you have a strong interest in looking at power dynamics in the healthcare system. And as you know, a lot of my work deals with the power tensions that exist between homeless youth and society. So maybe if you could talk a little bit more about power complexities and power dynamics.
Yeah, I mean, again, we mentioned briefly about the critical approach and the critical theorists, and I guess those are, I mean, the work of Marx, the work of Foucault, and the whole range of other sociological theorists which have sort of adopted the critical approach, really does sort of, help me think about the way I see power and the way it operates. So in healthcare, for instance, when one looks at the different professions, one can see that there are disparities between the way the professions are organised. Some professions are more privileged than others, and trying to understand that, because understanding the power dynamics and how power operates on an individual basis, but also on a structural basis, is something which can really illuminate how we do interprofessional education, how interprofessional teams operate in practice. So by adopting those critical approaches, adopting those theories, one can have a better understanding about how power sort of works and mm-hmm. how it can people can sort of encounter problems with it, how power can actually be empowering as well, or how one group can dominate another group.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, certainly I think a theoretical perspective is something which one needs to have to understand power. And it's sort of, it exists certainly through one's reading. It exists, wherever one looks. In relation to homelessness, you have, empowered people, you have disempowered people. The disempowered being homeless, homeless people.
Mm-hmm.
And then understanding, well, from their perspective, and it goes back to the qualitative approaches, what does it mean to be disempowered? And how could we, hopefully empower people? Because I think an important part of research is not just studying what happens, is also then taking action and interventions and intervening to improve things. So by going in and understanding how power operates in the context of homelessness, one can then develop approaches that maybe, hopefully, can empower people. And that might be including, getting policymakers involved, local charities, that kinds of thing.
Mm-hmm, definitely. Actually, this leads right into my next question, which is an ongoing struggle, and I'm sure for you as well, in your research on power dynamics. How do you find ways to empower people who are disempowered?
Wow, that's that's a good question. It's complicated, because I was mentioning about the sort of power operates on two basic levels in terms of individuals, between individuals. But also then structurally, there are power relations which are embedded in society. So for instance, if you come from a wealthy home, you structurally have more power and more influence because you have that sort of wealth under you, which is different from someone who's coming through a more sort of your typical kind of person. So to try to understand power. Well, in my world, I was mentioning about empowerment. So one needs to go and study the power relations, understand them, understand how they operate. And then from that knowledge, one can think about how one can intervene, how one can do things. So interpersonal education can be an empowering approach. So it can empower people to think about their position in relation to a healthcare team, and it can give them confidence, it can give them, you know, a set of competencies, if you like, to be able to then challenge that, or, you know, to be able to have a voice, to be aware of the issues that surround that, why they're in that position in that healthcare team. You know, it's not an accident that, you know, different professions are organised differently, and there are, you know, those that have more power and dominance than others.
Mm-hmm.
These are artifacts of, you know, social, economic, and political movements that the professions have engaged in over hundreds of years. So by, you know, developing sort of interpersonal education as a approach to empowerment, it gives people, you know, a voice, and they can understand about, well, why am I in this position compared to my colleague, and so therefore they can sort of challenge those things at a local level. Now, I mentioned earlier that the way power operates is on an individual basis and also on a structural basis, and there are only so many things you can do, I think, structurally, because, as I was saying, you know, power and the way the professions are organised, it means that there are different types of, you know, there's a hierarchy that exists, and you can only empower certain people to do so much, because mm-hmm. the structures will take time if you're going to try and change them. They can be changed, but they're very difficult. You know, to change the configuration of healthcare professions and the hierarchy that exists, it's going to take hundreds of years, because the professions have invested interests in keeping them as they are.
Right.
Because some professions will earn, you know, can actually earn more money than others, and they're not going to want to change things anytime soon. So you can empower people, but the empowerment has a limitation to it as well.
Mm-hmm. And what sort of advice can you offer to other researchers who are interested in research concerning power tensions and working with people who are disempowered?
Well, I think it's about going in, you know, adopting a sort of a qualitative ethnographic approach, going in and understanding what it means, how it looks from their perspective, to get an insider view from the way they're thinking in terms of their position and the way that they interact with, you know, different agencies, the way they interact with charities, the way they interact with, you know, the police force, for instance, if you think of it in a homelessness context, to understand, well, what does that mean? Because without a good understanding and a rich and an in-depth understanding, then one is going to struggle to create meaningful ways to start tackling some of the problems with the imbalances in power. So again, you know, if we think about the interprofessional stuff and the power sort of dynamics that works at work there, you know, one can create interventions to try and do some stuff there. So, you know, you can do similar things in relation to homelessness. Again, it's about understanding what's going on and then trying to think about how one can create approaches, initiatives, interventions to then, you know, tackle those imbalances
mm-hmm.
In certain ways. So again, it's understanding that, getting that in-depth, rich, contextual viewpoint from what it means from someone who's disempowered.
Mm-hmm.
And I think then you can start, once you have that knowledge, you have that data, you have that research, you can then start kind of maybe moving forward, engaging policymakers, engaging media, etc.
Right. Okay. And all this talk about power makes me think about qualitative research versus quantitative research, and how there's this notion that qualitative research is not valid, and that's because you know, it's not based on numbers, and a lot of people need numbers to be convinced or to believe in something. So how do you plead with people that do not believe in the value of qualitative research?
Well, it's interesting because I think in my field and generally in academia, that sort of mode of thinking is sort of outdated now. So people can understand that, you know, you do qualitative research because you'll need an in-depth understanding. You do quantitative research because then you want to go to a broader audience, or, you know, get broader data. So each have their own individual merits. So in academia, people will adopt different research approaches depending on what their needs are, depending on what their research questions are. I think there's a more common perception that anything without statistical sort of analyses and p-factors is suspicious. And actually, you know, in medicine and healthcare, there's a little sort of bit of a tendency to be less sort of trustworthy of, you know, an in-depth sort of ethnographic study, as opposed to a bunch of numbers, which tells you that a drug or something has this sort of outcome. So I think you're right. Yeah, I mean, there is an imbalance, and it's a traditional imbalance. It's been there for a number of years. It's beginning to be addressed. People are appreciating you do different things for different reasons. But it's definitely there, And mm-hmm. There are a number of people, my colleagues, who some of them don't particularly value qualitative research, mm-hmm. which is fine, And they do what they do. But generally, the shift is moving in a positive direction, I would say, mm-hmm. that people appreciate both sides of the coin, if you like.
Right, but it sounds like there's definitely a power tension between quantitative and qualitative research.
A little bit, and yeah. I think it's a historical sort of issue, and I think it's improving slowly.
Right, okay. And you also do a lot of work regarding collaboration and teamwork. And so I wanted to ask you, how do you suggest that we find ways to create more of a co-learning environment in the shelter system? Where staff can learn from people who are in the shelter system, because it's this exact conventional power dynamic that cuts communication and leads a system that's supposed to be offering support to become a system that offers very little support.
Mm. Well, I mean, it's interesting because there are some nice resonances between the stuff I do and your interests.
Mm.
And I think that, again, both are embedded in kind of power relationships. And the way to maybe think about how one can try and improve those power imbalances is to think about education, learning, training is one way to maybe get the shelter workers to make them more aware, to kind of enlighten them into the issues and what it's like from being homeless, what's that experience? So you can try and get the appreciation kind of built there. You can sort of run things together to have sessions where they can sort of discuss the shelter sort of workers and homeless clients and so there's opportunities for sharing, for learning together, for understanding each other's respective positions on where they're coming from, because mm-hmm. certainly in my field that can help kind of alleviate some of the kind of problems and some of the tension, because sometimes it's just down to sort of ignorance and a lack of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So by coming together and doing that, I think that's useful. And then also, so I think education plays a role. I then also think that you need obviously management support to then maybe change the way the shelters, the organisations are operated, to try and look at where there are problems within the organisational practices which might sort of exacerbate a problem. So it's about changing the way organisations work. So if it's a very hierarchical organisation, then look about ways to maybe flatten the hierarchies. Look at sort of the ways people can work together. There are regular opportunities for sharing and debriefing between shelter workers, between shelter workers and the homeless clients.
Mm-hmm.
So there are ways organisationally one can start addressing things, and as I said, educationally as well.
Yeah, absolutely. That's some really good advice. And you spoke about education, and that leads into my next question, which is it's an ongoing struggle of mine to find ways that my research can educate society and can push past these barriers. So my question to you is, how do we as researchers, how do we get people to listen to our voices, and how do we make our research have a strong impact on society?
Well, that's a very good question, and it's something that I struggle with my work, and I think all researchers do, and it's the issue of sort of knowledge translation.
Mm-hmm.
How do we translate the knowledge that we gain from our research studies to a broader audience? How do we make them come alive? How do we get people to sort of use them in their work? And it's a difficult thing to do, because I find with my work, just getting it to the practitioners is problematic, because they're not going to read the journals I publish my work in necessarily. So you have to think about, well, how do you translate those things? What are those vehicles where your target audience would sort of naturally pick up? So there are things like in the internet. So there were for getting messages out, there are sort of blogs that you can use. There's Facebook, there's Twitter as well. There are opportunities online that one can use to start getting those things out there. There are the typical kind of media sites as well, so newspapers, mm-hmm. trying to get I write a press release to try and get, you know, your work out there. So people who pick up the Toronto Star, for instance, will understand, you know, there's issues on homelessness out there. And you know, that then can, you know, start getting the work out there. So I think, you know, it's an internal problem how we actually make our work come alive. And it's a struggle and it's difficult, but I think one just needs to be creative and think about, as I said, modern technology is useful because everybody's sort of, you know, can pick up this stuff and access it fairly quickly as well. So that's certainly one way I think of going forward.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that these ways of, like these approaches that we use to effectively engage with people, do you think that it has to be different when we're trying to engage with policymakers and decision makers rather than just the general public?
Yeah, I mean, policymakers are a breed unto themselves. And actually here at St. Mike's, we often have policymakers come in and talk to the research community about their perspective. You know, that sort of idea about collaborating and co-learning. And you know, I'm always, when I can make it to these sessions, I'm always very interested about what the policymakers' view is. You know, policymakers generally want a very quick synopsis of the issue and how they may affect their policy making and how it may affect, you know, the work that they do at that level. They don't want to read a, you know, a huge sort of research paper. So I think there are, I think, yeah, one has to sort of be thoughtful about what type of media that they might pick up. I think the whole idea is sort of, you know, less is more for them. So, mm-hmm. you know, make it punchy, make it targeted. You know, I mean, often these policymakers have email, you know, and they can contact them via email. And if you can get maybe a meeting with them, we were working with some policymakers on a project recently, and you know, that was a nice piece of kind of knowledge translation because our work helped inform what they were doing. They wanted a lot of stuff from us in terms of just, you know, what are the main messages here. So we had to kind of distill a lot of quite complicated and detailed information to sort of, you know, very sort of easy chunk, sort of bite-sized pieces of information that they could use.
Mm-hmm.
So again, one has to be thoughtful and think about their, you know, policymakers' world. It's a fast-moving world. You know, policies can change very quickly depending mm-hmm. on, you know, public interest and public outcries over stuff. So, you know, one has to be mindful about the shifting nature of it, absolutely. But again, it's that, you know, eternal issue about how one translates.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you know, I think just one has to be targeted and use different ways. And if one way doesn't work, try another way, you know. And I think it's about persistence as well.
For sure, it's an ongoing process, just takes
Absolutely.
Time. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think you just keep on doing it. And you keep on, you know, making, maybe, you know, if there's an important message which isn't necessarily getting out there, then you just have to keep repeating that message in mm-hmm. different ways, by use of different media, you know, by addressing different people, you know, just to get that message out there. You know, it's like just having to repeat yourself. And eventually, over time, hopefully, this thing will happen. But you know, it's not going to happen in a one sort of, you know, hit deal. If you put something on a website for, you know, it just sits there. It has to be active, it has to be ongoing, and it has to be, you know, the message has to be repeated, I think. Often
mm-hmm.
takes time to get it over there. It's not a one-off deal. It's a continuing evolving process, as you say.
Yeah. Great. And what do you hope to achieve with your research, Scott?
Wow. that's a good question. I hope that my the powers that be at St. Mike's like the research and can continue to employ me. but no, seriously, what do I want to achieve? I think it's about coming and providing insight into the field that I work in and providing illumination about why we do things. I mean, often in the area that I work, people just get very enthusiastic about an idea and just go off and do stuff. And my point is, and my sort of work, will try to sort of understand what they're doing, why they're doing it, and what impact it has. To therefore, if it's good, then we can maybe design other things that can capitalise on that sort of positive nature. If it's bad or has no effect at all on anything, then we need to know that, so we need to kind of change things. So it's about trying to understand the field, trying to, you know, I mean, draw upon theories to illuminate our understanding, you know, collecting data to sort of get an insight into what's going on, and then creating approaches to improve the way that we do things. So it's that sort of iteration between research and action and research and action.
And what do you like most about your work?
It's a Good question. I actually like data collection. So I like doing interviews. I like hanging out and observing. In my job now, I don't get a lot of chance to do that because I'm often supervising and managing the process. So in the absence of actually collecting data and analysing it, I actually enjoy the sort of writing process. So I really enjoy sort of writing papers and editing papers. So yeah, I mean that's the sort of part I kind of enjoy. That's the only part I can really do now as well. So I don't have, as I said, don't have much option in terms of collecting or analysing. It's around the dissemination bit, which I think is a key point to it, and making sure that we get, you know, good material and it gets out there, gets disseminated and hopefully translated as well.
Definitely. And what would you say is most challenging about your job?
And it's well, in academia, it's getting grants, it's getting funding for the stuff that we do. And at the moment, you know, with the credit sort of crunch, it's a bit harder. And it's a lottery in many senses. You know, getting grant money to fund your work, it's a lottery. So you put your application in and you may or may not get it. You often don't, so you have to put other applications in. So it's kind of keeping that eye on, making sure there's money coming in to fund the activity. I mean, it's challenging, it's exciting as well, and you know, it's a great sort of boost when you get some funding in, you know, and it means that you can kind of push the work forward a little bit more. And that's, yeah, I guess that's the main challenge, is just making sure there's money there, so you always have to keep an eye on that.
For sure. And just one last sort of fun question to ask you. So if you didn't become a researcher, what would have been your number one job?
Interesting, actually. Yeah, I was thinking about that, and I've always liked actually writing. So I would have liked to have been a writer, fiction. I think fiction. Hmm. I'd like to have written fiction, which is sort of, I mean, I'm reading a lot of J.G. Ballard at the moment, and some of his earlier stuff from the 70s, and that type of, you know, it's not science fiction, it's not fantasy, but it draws upon kind of psychological kind of unease within individuals and marries it to sort of that sort of surrealism, that surrealist movement. Mm-hmm. So those sort of edgy novels I would have liked to have written.
That's great.
Or an astronaut.
Oh, that's wonderful. Okay, great. So is there anything else that maybe you wanted to add in before we end off our interview? No, okay. Great. Thanks so much, Scott.